Welcome. Today, we're embarking on an exploration of a truly critical area in pathology, immunohistochemistry, specifically the assessment of P53. Our mission is to unpack the latest findings from a Nordic External Quality Program's P53 evaluation round. We're aiming to understand what defines an optimal P53 assay and, well, to highlight the daily challenges laboratories navigate. This discussion should prove particularly relevant for you, whether you're a biomedical laboratory scientist, a lab technician, or perhaps a pathologist striving for the highest quality in your work.
And for those perhaps less familiar, the Nordic External Quality Program, you know, Nordic QC, it's a nonprofit global external quality assessment scheme. Based in Denmark, it's been operating for, well, over two decades now, serving more than 700 laboratories across the world. Their core mission is quite straightforward: to help laboratories achieve and consistently maintain optimal quality in immunohistochemistry. You can find a wealth of free resources on their website, www.nordicqc.org. This includes recommended protocols, guidance on common pitfalls, suggested tissue controls, all designed to support robust IHC quality.
That sounds like an invaluable resource for laboratories everywhere. To begin, let's lay some foundational understanding. What exactly is P53, and why is this accurate assessment so profoundly important in pathology?
P53 is truly a cornerstone of cellular health. It's a crucial tumor suppressor protein, often referred to as the guardian of the genome. And this description is quite accurate because of its vital role in maintaining genetic stability. Imagine your cells are constantly exposed to DNA damage, whether from normal metabolic processes, environmental toxins, or radiation. When such damage occurs, P53 springs into action. It's effectively the cell's sophisticated emergency response system.
So what specific actions does it take during such an emergency?
Well, P53 can trigger several critical responses. It might pause the cell cycle, allowing time for DNA repair to occur. Or if the damage is simply too severe to be repaired, it can initiate programmed cell death, known as apoptosis. This effectively eliminates potentially harmful cells before they can cause further problems. This entire regulatory network is the body's primary defense against accumulating mutations that could, you know, lead to disease.
And I imagine when that defense system falters, that's precisely where cancer can emerge.
Precisely. The TP53 gene, which codes for P53, is notably the most frequently mutated gene across all human cancers. It appears in roughly 50% of all cases. When P53 becomes non-functional or is entirely absent due to these mutations, damaged cells can continue to divide unchecked.
They effectively lose that crucial stop signal.
Yes, they lose that critical defense mechanism. And this significantly increases cancer risk. It can even influence how aggressive certain cancers are, as well as their response to therapy. It really underscores its fundamental role.
Thinking historically, how was P53 typically assessed in the laboratory? And how has our understanding of its expression patterns evolved over time?
That's a crucial point that has reshaped our approach. For many years, the sole focus was on P53 overexpression. A strong, widespread P53 signal was generally correlated directly with underlying TP53 mutations. However, our understanding has broadened significantly. We now recognize other vital reaction patterns. For instance, the zero pattern, where P53 expression is completely absent in tumor cells.
So no staining at all.
Exactly. And this absence, perhaps counterintuitively, can also correlate with distinct TP53 mutations. So it's no longer just about detecting an abundance of P53 signal. It's equally critical to correctly identify its absence or even low-level expression, which is the wild-type pattern. This nuanced understanding fundamentally reshaped how Nordic QC conducts its P53 quality assessments, leading to updated criteria since 2021. The program has continuously evolved, to align with changing clinical needs, moving beyond just overexpression to assess the full spectrum: absence, wild type, and overexpression.
That paradigm shift makes perfect sense. With this evolving understanding, what are some of the key practical challenges Nordic QC has observed laboratories facing when performing P53 assessment?
A significant practical challenge, one we've observed repeatedly, is that there isn't currently a single ready-to-use product on the market that is perfectly calibrated. Calibrated to detect all the relevant P53 staining patterns we now recognize as clinically important. Most of these ready-to-use kits, often called RTUs, were initially developed and calibrated to primarily highlight only the overexpression pattern. That was the prevailing focus then.
So they might miss the more subtle but equally critical patterns.
Precisely. That's the core issue, really. This means they often lack the sensitivity required to demonstrate low expression, such as the wild-type pattern, which is your normal P53 baseline, or the rarer cytoplasmic staining. Both are now understood to be vital for accurate diagnosis in specific contexts.
And recognizing that normal, wild-type pattern is also critically important. What makes that so key?
It acts as your crucial reference point. It's how you accurately identify the zero type, the complete absence of P53 expression in the tumor. This absence can directly indicate a specific and significant type of TP53 mutation. You need to be confident that your assay can detect normal P53 levels to be certain that any observed absence is a genuine biological finding, not a technical oversight.
It sounds like a significant hurdle for laboratories that rely heavily on these RTU kits. These products then essentially require a fundamental recalibration.
They absolutely do. Since these ready-to-use products were calibrated before the full spectrum of reaction patterns was fully appreciated, well, there's an urgent need for their recalibration. This would ensure true plug-and-play functionality across all relevant patterns, providing laboratories with the comprehensive diagnostic tools they need, without necessitating extensive and often difficult in-house optimization.
Okay, let's turn to NordicQC's latest data. What was the specific objective of this recent P53 evaluation, and what kind of material was used for the assessment?
NordicQC's primary objective was to evaluate the technical performance, meaning the analytical sensitivity and specificity of the P53 immunohistochemistry tests used by participating laboratories. The focus was specifically on their ability to demonstrate corresponding TP53 mutations in endometrial carcinomas, which served as the primary clinical context for this round. To achieve this, a comprehensive range of clinical tissues, both normal and neoplastic, was carefully incorporated. These tissues were selected to display a broad spectrum of P53 antigen expression levels.
And specifically, what tissue samples were included on the slides for this particular round?
Slides for P53 staining comprise 5 specific tissue samples: appendix, tonsil, a low-grade endometrial carcinoma that was P53 wild type, an endometrial serous carcinoma showing complete absence of P53, and finally, an endometrial serous carcinoma exhibiting P53 overexpression.
Covering all the critical expression patterns then, a robust panel. What did an optimal P53 staining result look like in this assessment? What were the key criteria NordicQC used for evaluation?
Well, the criteria for optimal P53 staining included weak to moderate nuclear staining in the germinal center B cells of the tonsil and in dispersed epithelial cells within the basal crypts of the appendix. These represent expected normal expression levels.
And for cases where P53 was expected to be absent in the tumor?
For the endometrial serous carcinoma with P53 absence, the criteria mandated no staining in the neoplastic cells themselves. Critically, however, dispersed stromal cells, lymphocytes, and endothelial cells within that very same core had to show at least weak nuclear staining.
Ah, the crucial internal control.
Exactly. They function as vital internal positive controls, confirming the assay's sensitivity for normal P53, even when the tumor itself is negative. The assessment also looked for appropriate weak to moderate staining in the low-grade endometrial carcinoma, again with internal controls confirming sensitivity. These detailed criteria ensure the assay can accurately identify the full spectrum of clinically relevant P53 patterns, not just the easily detectable ones.
Now, looking at the overall results from this round, how many laboratories participated and what was the general pass rate?
There were 397 laboratories participating in this assessment. Of those, 65% achieved a sufficient mark, categorized as either optimal or good.
65%? Is that a typical pass rate for this kind of marker?
It varies by assay, but for a marker of such importance, and with well-established antibody clones available, 65% is certainly in the lower range. There's definite room for improvement.
I see. And what were the most common reasons laboratories struggled? What led them to fall into that insufficient category?
The vast majority of insufficient results, 84% to be precise, were due to a staining reaction that was simply too weak, or even outright false negative.
So predominantly sensitivity issues.
Yes, largely. The most common underlying causes included using a less sensitive detection system, inefficient heat-induced epitope retrieval protocols, and sometimes the use of, let's say, less successful antibodies. A smaller percentage, about 5%, exhibited false positive staining, with other issues accounting for the remainder. But weak staining was indeed the dominant problem.
You've discussed the evolving understanding of P53 and how NordicQC's assessment criteria have changed. How has performance historically evolved across these P53 assessment rounds, particularly given this shift in focus?
That's a very insightful question. This is NordicQC's 6th P53 assessment. While the current pass rate of 65% was identical to Run 67 from last year, it's notably reduced compared to our very first P53 assessments. For example, in Run 38, the pass rate was 79%. This discrepancy, we believe, is directly linked to the altered focus for P53. Since the criteria change in run 63, and in every run since, we've seen the TAS rates gradually increase, but it remains a challenging assay.
In what specific way did it become more challenging for the laboratories?
Previously, the primary focus was on demonstrating P53 overexpression, which often yields a strong, easily detectable signal. While nearly all laboratories can demonstrate P53 in high-level antigen expression samples, such as the endometrial serous carcinoma with overexpression, successfully demonstrating P53 in low-level structures proved much more difficult.
You mean like the internal controls?
Precisely. Detecting P53 in stromal cells, lymphocytes, and endothelial cells within cases where the tumor shows loss of P53, or in the neoplastic cells of a P53 wild-type, low-grade endometrial carcinoma, requires extremely carefully calibrated protocols. Much greater precision is needed.
That certainly illustrates the increased analytical rigor now required. What were the key takeaways regarding specific antibody clones and general laboratory practices that consistently led to success in this assessment?
Based on our findings, the monoclonal antibody clones DO7 and BP5311, available both as concentrated formats and ready-to-use products, are highly formidable. Both perform well when optimized. We observed a consistent trend. Ready-to-use formats generally yielded a lower pass rate compared to concentrated antibodies used in laboratory-developed tests, or LDTs. These RTUs often required significant in-house optimization by the laboratories to achieve optimal or even just good results.
So concentrated antibodies, when optimized, show a higher pass rate, but they require more in-house work. However, when a laboratory purchases a ready-to-use product, there's an inherent expectation, isn't there, that it should be optimized by the vendor, especially given its higher cost. Would you agree that's the ideal scenario?
You've articulated the ideal scenario perfectly. That's indeed what would be preferable, yes.
Okay, so this is definitely a key issue. What about specific automated platforms? Did NordicQC identify any common denominators for success when using concentrated formats there?
Yes, there were clear platform-specific trends. For Ventana benchmark systems, optimal results typically required heat-induced epitope retrieval in CC1 for at least 48 minutes, dot combined with a three-step detection system. On Danko Omnis, it was usually heat-induced epitope retrieval in TRS high pH for at least 30 minutes, combined with the Envision Flex Plus system, that means the Envision system with an appropriate linker. For the Autostainer system, similar conditions were needed. Heat-induced epitope retrieval in TRS high pH for at least 20 minutes, again with Envision Flex Plus. On the Leica Bond platform, performance was unfortunately somewhat inferior overall in this assessment, but we still recommend initiating heat-induced epitope retrieval in BEERS 2 for at least 20 minutes as a starting point. These specific recommendations underscore the critical need for fine-tuning. It's certainly not a one-size-fits-all approach.
You touched upon the performance difference between concentrated and ready-to-use antibodies earlier. Could you elaborate a bit more on their overall performance across all participants?
Certainly. Approximately 23% of participating laboratories used concentrated antibodies within their own laboratory-developed tests. A large majority of those, 92%, utilized the DO7 clone. These concentrated formats achieved a respectable 73% pass rate overall. And optimal results were routinely obtained on the main automated immunohistochemistry systems where labs had optimized their conditions appropriately. And what were those key conditions for optimal performance with the concentrated formats? The prerequisites for optimal staining were consistent, efficient heat-induced epitope retrieval, usually in an alkaline buffer, careful calibration of the primary antibody titer, which is paramount, and employing a sensitive detection system.
And what about the majority, the 77% of laboratories using their ready-to-use antibodies? How did they fare overall?
It's a stark contrast, unfortunately. When these ready-to-use systems were applied using only the vendor-recommended protocol settings, the pass rates and the proportion of optimal results were, frankly, quite low. We observed an overall pass rate of only 30% for vendor protocols, with a mere 2% achieving optimal results.
Only a 30% pass rate and just 2% optimal simply by following the provided instructions. That's quite a significant finding.
It clearly highlights the critical need for laboratories to go beyond those default settings. They need to perform further calibration or optimization of these RTU systems for this specific P53 application, especially for detecting the full spectrum of P53 expression.
So it sounds like optimization efforts for RTU systems were indeed successful. What kinds of modifications specifically proved most impactful?
Oh, the impact of modification was often profound. Take the RTU system for the Omnis platform as an example. Laboratories that modify the protocol settings achieved an impressive 86% pass rate overall, compared to just 30% if they strictly followed the vendor-recommended settings.
That's a remarkable difference.
It truly is. And the single most successful modification we observed for that system was adding a mouse linker to essentially upgrade the detection to the Envision Flex Plus system. That specific modification boosted the pass rate to 86%. We saw very similar trends with the RTU system for the auto stainer laboratories. Using Envision Flex Plus as their detection system resulted in a 71% pass rate versus only 20% for those using the standard recommended two-step Envision Flex.
So it demonstrates that even with a ready-to-use kit, optimizing its protocol, particularly the detection step, seems absolutely critical for P53 assessment.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just detection systems. For the widely used Ventana RTU system, which also uses the DO7 clone, prolonging the heat-induced epitope retrieval time was a common and highly effective modification. For instance, performing heat-induced epitope retrieval for 48 minutes or more resulted in an 80% pass rate. This is significantly higher than the 47% pass rate observed when labs use 40 minutes or less. The other Ventana RTU system, based on the BP5311 clone, showed very similar beneficial results with extended heat-induced epitope retrieval times. More time genuinely helped sensitivity. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, the Leica Biosystems RTU system showed an inferior pass rate in this assessment compared to previous runs. Even with modifications, both vendor-recommended and modified settings yielded low pass rates, around 21-25%, with no optimal results observed in this round for that specific kit.
That's truly valuable, practical information. Now, a final but absolutely critical question for all laboratories doing this work. What are the definitive recommended controls for P53 immunohistochemistry, and why is it so important to get them right?
Controls are foundational for accurate immunohistochemistry. Tonsil and appendix are your most reliable external positive and negative tissue controls. For an accurate P53 IHC test, when using tonsil, you should observe that more than 50% of the germinal center B cells show weak to moderate nuclear staining, while less than 50% of the mantle zone B cells should be demonstrated. And in the appendix, dispersed epithelial cells within the basal crypts must show weak to moderate nuclear staining, while importantly, the luminal epithelial cells must be negative.
And that rigorously checks both sensitivity and specificity. So those are the external checks. What about within the patient sample itself?
Yes, and this is truly crucial. Beyond those external controls, it's absolutely vital to emphasize that stromal cells, lymphocytes, and endothelial cells within the clinical samples themselves serve as essential internal positive tissue controls. This is particularly important for assessing carcinomas that might possess PP53 mutations causing absence or loss of P53 expression in the tumor cells.
Why are they especially vital in these specific cases?
Because observing positive staining in those normal internal cells confirms that your assay is functioning correctly, that it can detect normal or low-level P53 expression. This tells you that any observed tumor negativity is a genuine biological finding, not merely a technical failure of your assay. They function as a kind of built-in quality check for every single slide you evaluate.
That makes perfect sense. To synthesize the key findings from this assessment, what's the most important takeaway message for our listeners running P53 immunohistochemistry?
I think the main message from the Nordic QC P53 assessment is this. Both of the main antibody clones, BP5311 and DO7, can absolutely achieve optimal P53 staining results. The most widely used clone, DO7, performed optimally across all the main immunohistochemistry systems when the conditions were right. For optimal performance with any clone, efficient heat-induced epitope retrieval and careful calibration of the primary antibody titer are simply mandatory. You must get those steps right. And critically, a three-layer detection system is essential. We observed that participants using a three-layer system achieved a 78% pass rate overall. Compare that to a 0% pass rate for those using a two-layer detection system. The difference in sensitivity is stark and, well, unequivocal.
That's a profound difference in outcome.
It really is. We also found that protocols based on a concentrated antibody format still show a slight edge in pass rates, around 71%, compared to the corresponding ready-to-use systems at 63%. This again highlights the ongoing need for optimization with RTUs. And importantly, while the overall pass rate was stable compared to the previous run 67, it does remain lower than earlier assessments, such as run 38, which had a 79% pass rate.
And that's due to the increased analytical challenge, as you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. We believe it's not a decline in general laboratory capability, but rather a direct reflection of the increased complexity now demanded of the P53 assay. The focus for P53 immunohistochemistry, particularly in endometrial carcinomas, is fundamentally shifted. It has moved from solely detecting overexpression to reliably identifying TP53 mutations that result in the loss of P53 expression and even cytoplasmic staining. This newer requirement demands consistent demonstration of P53 expression in those crucial internal control cells and typically necessitates a careful recalibration of the immunohistochemistry test itself. This is something ready-to-use systems, when simply used plug-and-play, don't adequately account for.
This truly underscores the constantly evolving landscape of diagnostic pathology, doesn't it? And the absolute importance of adapting protocols to meet these new clinical needs and our improved biological understanding. It's certainly clear that in the world of P53 assessment, a set-it-and-forget-it approach is definitely not a viable option.
Continuous attention and adaptation are indeed needed. For more in-depth information, including detailed protocols that performed well, the full evaluation criteria, and images of recommended controls, we strongly encourage you to visit our website at www.nordicqc.org. All these resources are freely available. NordicQC's aim is to support laboratories everywhere in delivering the highest quality immunohistochemistry possible.
We certainly hope this discussion has provided you with valuable insights into optimizing your own P53 assessments and perhaps a deeper understanding of the nuances of this truly critical biomarker. Thank you for joining us today.